Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday, the 17th of May, these are our main stories. The United States has urged Israel to do more to allow humanitarian access to both southern and northern Gaza, and the European Union begins a formal investigation into allegations that Facebook and Instagram are failing to protect the safety of children. Also in this podcast, how disinformation is spreading about the causes and responses to the flooding in Brazil, and
some of you may go on to lead successful careers in the world, but I would venture to guess that the majority of you are most excited about your marriage and the children you will bring into this world.
America's National Football League distances itself from the player accused of sexism and homophobia. The US State Department has urged Israel to do more to provide sustained humanitarian access to both southern and northern Gaza. Egypt stopped allowing in supplies after Israel seized control of the Gaza side. The UN's aid chief has warned that famine is now an imminent risk in Gaza. Martin Griffiths said UN staff were struggling to help people displaced by the Israeli offensive on Rafah, and stocks of food were running out. A US State Department spokesman, Vedant Patel, said Washington was working to make the Rafah crossing run effectively.
We are continuing to be concerned that travel and the flow of fuel of aid into Gaza via Rafah has come to a complete halt. But we are continuing to work with the government of Egypt, with the government of Israel, to do everything we can to make sure that this gets open as soon as possible.
It's more pressure on Israel after South Africa, in submissions to the International Court of Justice in The Hague, described the operation in Rafah as part of an end game in which Gaza is utterly destroyed. South Africa says Palestinian people in Gaza are being killed, maimed, displaced and starved. A lawyer arguing the case on behalf of South Africa, Max du Plessis, accused Israel of deliberately killing Palestinians by thwarting efforts to get humanitarian aid into the territory.
If Israel continues to deny that its bombing and shelling and military incursions and blocking of roads and entry points and its other military operations in Gaza are preventing the fulfilment of the court's orders, the court needs to spell it out explicitly for Israel and for the benefit of any other states that are still providing aid or assistance to Israel in its campaign to eradicate Palestine.
Israel will give evidence to the court later today and has always insisted it is acting within international law. Our reporter Will Vernon is in Washington. And just before we came in to record this podcast, I asked him exactly what it is that the US is asking for when it urges Israel to provide more humanitarian access to Gaza.
Well, Jackie, US officials say that more humanitarian assistance is desperately needed in Gaza. The US State Department today, you heard in the clip you played there, reiterated a plea made many, many times over the past few months for Israel to allow more aid into Gaza via crossing points. I think the Americans are hoping that their opening of a temporary pier will perhaps put some more pressure on the Israelis. That pier was anchored to the shoreline near Gaza City today, as we heard. And the floating platform a little further from the beach is already in place. That will receive aid in the coming days, according to the US military. No US troops will be involved in unloading that aid. The job will fall to the UN. They're ready to start distributing supplies. And that floating port will provide between 90 and 150 trucks worth of aid per day. That is important. And that will help, of course, but it is far less than the people of Gaza need. Aid agencies say all this is nowhere near enough. And US officials have said repeatedly that the best way of getting aid into Gaza is via land crossings. President Biden has talked about this a lot. He stressed the importance of it, of allowing more aid in phone calls with the Israelis. The flow of aid via land crossings was one of the reasons why he made that ultimatum to the Israeli Prime Minister last month. We remember it, don't we, in that tense phone call when Mr. Biden said to Mr. Netanyahu, you need to take concrete steps to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza, otherwise US policy on the war could change. And it did change, didn't it? Supplies of heavy weapons, supplies from the US to Israel, those munitions that can be used in population centres such as Rafah, they've been paused for the time being. And other future supplies are under review. But the State Department said today that humanitarian conditions on the ground in Gaza continue to deteriorate. So I think officials now will be rushing to get as much aid as possible, right, via this floating port. But that's meant to that's supposed to supplement land crossings, not replace them. So I think they'll be looking to put more pressure on the Israelis to change course on those land crossings. And if they don't, I think the Biden administration will consider pausing even more weapons shipments. So we'll have to see what happens with that in the coming days.
That was Will Vernon in Washington. When the European Union goes after big tech companies, it doesn't muck about. The fines can run into the billions. Now the EU has got Meta in its sights. It's opened a formal investigation into Facebook and Instagram over allegations they aren't doing enough to keep children safe. The big numbers go beyond fines. About 3 billion people worldwide are active on Facebook. Our technology reporter Shona McCallum told us more.
The European Commission are concerned that it's still far too easy for under 18s to not just actively seek out this kind of content, but also accidentally stumble across it. And they looked at addictive behaviour as well, because there's this thing known as the rabbit hole effect, which is something that they've spoken about extensively, which basically is you being shown more and more material and lead you to something else that you might like. And, you know, that's part of the appeal. But in some cases, this leads to more dangerous content, and that is harmful content, which is what the legislation is trying to crack down on.
So these investigations have been launched, a shot, if you like, fired across the bows. What more realistically can an organisation like Meta do to ensure that these algorithms don't send vulnerable young people down dangerous rabbit holes, to ensure that there are proper age requirements and so on?
Well, there are various things that they have already tried to do, like age verification, stopping certain age groups going online, you know, giving more parental controls. They say that they are developing tools all the time designed to protect children, taking down content clearly if something is flagged to them. Lots of ways that, you know, if you saw something that was unsuitable on Instagram or Facebook, that you can flag and report it. But clearly this industry is moving quickly. And I think lots of social media companies are grappling with that very question. You know, what can they do? How can they prove to the legislators that they are indeed making changes? We've spoken to Meta today. They say that they, of course, want young people to have a safe and age-appropriate experience on their platforms, and that they are looking forward to sharing the more intimate details of the workings with the European Commission. So I suppose that may come out in the future, you know, what incremental or major changes they might be making, but these tools and policies are changing all the time.
And if the investigators are not satisfied, Meta could be fined up to 6% of its annual global turnover. We're talking about huge sums of money here, aren't we?
That's absolutely right. And clearly one of the big things about this legislation is that, you know, these violations and the kind of impending fines, if you like, they are hopeful to be enough of a threat to really spur these social media companies into action. Because a lot of these social media companies, Meta in particular, for a long time has been blamed for showing young people inappropriate content and not really doing anything other than paying the fine, which quite frankly is a drop in the ocean.
Shona McCallum. The US government is spending hundreds of billions of dollars transforming the energy industry to try to compete with China on green manufacturing. It's led to a boom in factories and a stronger economy, but there are fears it's also fueling inflation and record debt. The state of the economy will be a crucial issue in the presidential election later this year. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, reports from the southern US state of Georgia.
Here in Georgia, the landscape is changing. Diggers, levellers and concrete mixers are reshaping the southern Bible Belt of America as the Battery Belt, as the USA throws money at outcompeting China in manufacturing a variety of electric cars. And where some of these vehicles are going, they won't need roads.
So we're building an all-electric vertical takeoff aircraft, which is basically a flying car.
Tosha Perkins helps run Archer Aviation, which plans to open the new factory within a year.
This flying car will hold 4 passengers plus a pilot, mass-produced here, in the hundreds to thousands flying cars per year. We're going to be getting up to thousands of jobs.
How much support from U.S. government and state government have you had?
Tremendous support from the U.S. government and federal, local, and state level. Obviously, green energy is incredibly important to them, but the U.S. also wants to continue being a leader in aviation and aerospace. So those two things combined is the reason we're getting so much support.
Vehicles aren't the only thing taking off vertically here. The monthly spend on private manufacturing construction across the U.S. has shot up more than trebling to nearly $20 billion a month. Half of that is being spent in the South. President Biden's huge investments of US taxpayers' money are part of the reason that the economy has more than defied expectations of a recession. Indeed, this is how Jamie Dimon, the Wall Street titan who runs JP Morgan, describes it.
It's unbelievable. But you know, if you look at it, I mean, it's basically booming. It's been booming for a while, you know, since COVID, kind of before there was slow growth. But if you look at the economy since then, you know, it's been booming.
Back in the central square of Covington in Georgia, tourists mingle with locals. And while the economy looks strong, the problem for President Biden is at the local ice cream parlour.
Hi, welcome to Scoops.
Voters aren't feeling a boom or even a recovery from recent price hikes.
Do people feel like it's gone well over the past few years?
Not at all. Not at all. And hopefully it'll get better this coming, you know, election year, but we'll see.
How does it feel right now in terms of the U.S. economy?
It's not terrible. I mean, we adjust to it, cost of everything, and you just kind of move on. We're not going to stop living life because things are, but just work harder. Yeah. That's our motto.
So most places are saying they can't find people to work. And so I'm like, well, if you can't find people to work, then why are our numbers so high? So, like, especially after COVID.
This is the flip side of a strong economy, inflation proving more stubborn in the U.S., and that presents a big dilemma here in Georgia's capital at the Atlanta branch of the Federal Reserve, which helps decide U.S. interest rates.
I expect the U.S. economy to be strong, to continue to be strong, but not quite this strong.
That was Rafael Bostich, the president of the Atlanta branch of the Fed. It's expected rate cuts have been slowed, perhaps even put off till next year, with consequences for borrowing rates around the world. And from this quarter, there are new concerns about surging U.S. government debts.
That you're noting that more and more people are asking whether our budgetary approach is a good thing, to me that says, okay, now maybe we should be having that conversation about, are we undermining the confidence in the full faith and credit of the U.S. government? Because we really can't afford to do that.
Across the U.S., these government-backed green investments are leading to new inflation and debt risks, but they're also helping the economy defy expectations. It will matter for the election here in the U.S. and for the world economy too.
Faisal Islam. There are no roads through the Darien Gap, the jungle which straddles part of the border between Panama and Colombia, but it's become a key highway for desperate people hoping to make their way eventually to the United States and a better life. Recent figures have revealed some worrying trends, as Vanessa Buchluter reports.
The number of children, those under the age of 18, who are crossing this dangerous stretch of jungle between Panama and Colombia has surged. It is up by 40% compared to last year. What UNICEF, the United Nations Children Agency, did was to count the number of children who are going through this stretch of jungle, and they found that more than 30,000 had crossed it between January and the end of April. So in those 4 months alone, 30,000 children. Many of those children are unaccompanied. They're there on their own, without a guardian, without parents. And you cannot overestimate how dangerous this stretch of jungle is. There are criminal gangs who prey on migrants. There has been a lot of sexual violence. Doctors Without Borders has reported that in 1 month alone, there were 214 cases of sexual violence in that stretch of jungle. And some of them were actually children. So you can see the risks to these children who embark on this journey trying to get north, often to the United States.
Vanessa Buchluter. It's traditional for graduation ceremonies in the US to have a guest speaker, and most try to say something inspiring about the future to usher students out into the world feeling uplifted. But a speech by a Super Bowl-winning American footballer has backfired. Harrison Butker has been accused of sexism and homophobia, and a petition calling for him to be sacked by the Kansas City Chiefs now has more than 100,000 signatures. More from our North America correspondent, Emma Vardy.
Ladies and gentlemen of the class of 2024.
In the 20-minute-long speech given for students graduating at a school in Kansas, Harrison Butker, a three-time Super Bowl champion, took a swipe at Pride Month, talked about a woman's role as a homemaker, and criticized Catholic Church leaders for what he said was an erosion of Catholic values. He congratulated women for graduating, but said most were excited about marriage and becoming a mother.
I think it is you, the women, who have had the most diabolical lies told to you. How many of you are sitting here now about to cross this stage and are thinking about all the promotions and titles you are going to get in your career? Some of you may go on to lead successful careers in the world, but I would venture to guess that the majority of you are most excited about your marriage and the children you will bring into this world.
The speech has gone viral online, with many people responding on social media.
This is the most insane graduation speech I have ever heard in my life.
Who just really went in and told these women who have spent tens of thousands of dollars getting their degrees that those degrees ain't and that they need to just wife up.
The idea that a woman's worth is tied to her ability to be a wife is like it's stuck in the Stone Ages.
The petition calling for the player to be sacked is gaining signatures at pace. It says his remarks were sexist, homophobic and racist, and that it's unacceptable for such a public figure to use a platform in this way. It's now reached 100,000 names. The Kansas Chiefs NFL team, the current Super Bowl champions, hasn't commented on Harrison Butker's speech, but the player has previously made his Catholic beliefs well known. The NFL's vice president has said the player gave a speech in his personal capacity and that his views are not those of the NFL as an organization.
Emma Vardy. Still to come, 8 weeks after a container vessel destroyed a bridge in Baltimore, a visit to the sailors still stranded on board the ship.
They were happy to see smiling faces that weren't asking them a million questions.
The authorities in the Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul say they're planning to build four of what they call provisional cities, offering temporary accommodation to people who've been displaced by devastating floods. Nearly 80,000 people are currently living in shelters. More than 600,000 have left their homes since the first storms hit nearly 3 weeks ago. 151 people are now known to have died. The authorities are also having to battle a wave of disinformation about the causes of the floods and the authorities' response. Leandro Prezeres from the BBC Sao Paulo Bureau told James Menendez more.
One of them was a conspiracy theory according to which the floods were not caused by climate event, but rather by a secret US project that would use antennas to artificially change the weather. Another one was about donations to help people right now. Several messages were posted online saying that the local and the federal government were putting obstacles to the distribution of food, clothes and medicines.
Also rumours about the authorities hiding bodies, is that right?
Yes, and again, there is no indication that the government is hiding the bodies.
And what about in terms of the response by the army, for example, and rescue workers? Has there been disinformation going around about that too?
Of course, because of the dimension of this crisis, people are having the impression that the government is not doing enough, that the military is not doing enough. But when you go to the ground, you're going to see military, you're going to see forces from federal and local government, as well as volunteers. They are working together here. And of course, there are a lot of things to do, but it's not true that the military is not working in the region.
I mean, is it clear at all who might be behind this disinformation? And also, I mean, what might be the reason for it?
Well, it's not clear. And if there's some sort of coordination or if there's just like a political group behind this. What specialists are saying is that most of this misinformation has been targeting the credibility of Brazilian institutions in a very crucial moment, because the country is completely mobilized in order to deal with this crisis. And it's important to note that it's happening in a time when Brazil is still highly polarized.
And is there anything the authorities can do to try and control this flow of disinformation? I mean, have they said anything about it?
What's going on right now is that the local and the federal government have launched campaigns against misinformation specifically related to what's going on here in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. In addition to that, the Brazilian Federal Police has also launched a formal investigation in order to identify the people behind this wave of misinformation that's taking place in such a crucial moment of the country.
Leandro Prazeres in Brazil. On March the 26th, the Dali, a massive container ship, drifted into a huge road bridge in Baltimore and brought it down, killing six road workers who were on the bridge at the time. The tragedy was reported worldwide. Well, now, 8 weeks on, it turns out that the mostly Indian crew of the ship are still stuck there, on board by the damaged bridge, and not allowed to get off. But maritime unions are calling for them to be given a break on land. Barbara Shipley is a U.S. representative with the International Transportation Workers Federation. Evan Davis asked her why the sailors were still aboard the Dali.
The vessel has been stuck in the channel with pieces of the bridge still laying on top, so they couldn't move the vessel until they cleared the channel of the bridge debris for safe navigation. The crew, they're on board because they know the vessel better than anyone for investigations, helping people, you know, crash investigators getting to certain parts of the vessel. Outside of that, they still have to maintain the vessel, you know, run the generators, keeping eye on the anchors that are out, assisting with the salvage teams. So the crew has been very busy.
They've had their phones taken away from them, though, I think.
Yes, sir. You know, as in any standard investigation, they're looking at all avenues, and FBI did take the cell phones with the promise to return them within 24 to 48 hours, and they've not been returned as of now.
How long ago was that? How long ago were they taken?
They took the phones on April the 15th.
They have contact with the outside, presumably some contact, yes, radio contact.
Yes, they do. But it was just a shock, you know, 3 weeks after the accident, now someone takes their cell phones away and that immediate communication is gone. The photos on the phone, their families, how we feel if our phone is lost. It's a panic.
So the company gave them new cell phones, but obviously yes, they didn't have all the stuff that was on the old
they
cell phone.
They had nothing. It's a brand new empty cell phone.
There's no way in which they can come off and just have a rest. I mean, obviously someone's got to look after the ship while it is stuck there, but they can't come off, do some shopping, just get their feet on land.
Time. They're working on surveying the vessel to make sure it's seaworthy to tow it to the nearest port, which is, I think, 2 miles away. So it's fairly close. But once it gets alongside, then we'll be petitioning our Customs and Border Patrol asking for shore leave.
Barbara, you have visited the ship. When did you visit the ship?
I went out last week of April, and then the first week of May I've been on board.
How are they? How are they faring? Because they do spend a long time at sea sometimes, so it's not like they're not used to being on a ship.
Let's absolutely
be clear. That is their big part of their life. But how are they? How did you find them?
They were happy to see smiling faces that weren't asking them a million questions.
Where does this end, and when does it end?
When? I really don't know. Our hope is that there will be some decisions made soon on which seafarers they'd like to keep around for further questioning, but not all crew members are going to be needed. And We're hoping to get those crew members home as soon as the DOJ says they're not needed anymore.
Barbara Shipley. Algerian media say a man who disappeared nearly 30 years ago has been found alive in a neighbour's cellar. Omar Ben Omran was 17 when he was kidnapped. Here's Mike Thompson.
In 1998, Omar Ben Omran suddenly vanished from his home in northern Algeria. His grieving family came to assume he'd been killed in the country's civil war. Then, nearly 30 years later, he was discovered in a small, squalid cellar just 200 metres from his home. Mr. Ben Omran, now 45, reportedly said he'd been unable to call for help because his captor had cast a spell on him. He's been given medical and psychological help. A 61-year-old security guard has been arrested in connection with the kidnap.
Mike Thompson. India's most famous footballer, Sunil Chhetri, has decided to retire from the sport. The 39-year-old has often carried his team for a generation, but he will play his final match on June the 6th. Our own Nigel Adderley has commentated on games Chhetri has played in, and he looks back now on his career.
Sunil Chhetri brings it down. Chhetri! Oh, it's beautiful! It's glorious! It's serene! He's India's one-man goal-scoring machine!
In a country obsessed with cricket, Sunil Chhetri has at times single-handedly thrust India into the football spotlight. Only Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo have scored more international goals among active players. But after 94 in 150 appearances for his country, Chhetri has decided to call time on a career during which he's been a talisman for India, as the sport has endured a huge surge of interest in South Asia. Since scoring on his debut in 2005, Chhetri has led the Blue Tigers to a host of regional honours, but has never been able to guide his country to a World Cup. And during a video message on social media, he admitted the decision to retire wasn't an easy one.
When the instinct came that it should be my last game, then I thought about it a lot. And eventually I came to this decision, so... No. Will I be sad after this? Of course. Do I feel sad sometimes every day because of this? Yes. It took time because the kid inside me, he never wants to stop if given a chance to play for his country, man. Never.
India's cricket captain Virat Kohli was among the first to pay tribute to Chhetri. And there's no doubt his final game, a World Cup qualifier against Kuwait next month, will mark the end of an era. Many fans will find it difficult to say goodbye, but replacing India's football icon may prove to be even harder.
Nigel Adderley. Now, fancy a trip to Singapore?
Welcome to world class. Welcome to Singapore Airlines.
Singapore Airlines staff are reportedly being given bonuses worth nearly 8 months' salary. The bumper payout comes after the airline earned record profits of nearly $2 billion in the last financial year. Many employers give bonuses to their workers in Singapore, but rarely this much. Our East Asia regional editor, Mickey Bristow, told us more.
Yeah, it's a pretty massive bonus, isn't it? And I'm sure every worker across the globe would be happy to receive it in their pay packet. This is for cabin crew at Singapore Airlines, also pilots. So a whole range of people, they're going to get a big pay packet.
So why?
That's a good question. Singapore Airlines itself hasn't officially commented on it, so we're not quite sure why. But perhaps it's a reward for staff who have just come out of a pretty tough period like all airlines. They suffered during COVID. Planes just didn't fly. People weren't flying. In Singapore Airlines, the pilots took a massive cut. A lot of the staff had to go and work in other jobs as well. They had to work in hospitals or transport hubs in Singapore. And perhaps you could see this as a reward for that lean period.
So is Singapore Airlines back to where it was pre-pandemic?
They have managed to bounce back quite well. I mean, one of the reasons they did that was because Singapore was quite quick to open up after COVID. Another reason was that Singapore Airlines was able to move back up to capacity. So what happened after COVID, there was a lot of demand. Airlines couldn't fill that capacity because they'd sacked a lot of workers. Singapore Airlines didn't do that. It gave them pay cuts and put them on other jobs so it could bring them back quite quickly. So that's perhaps why it's rebounded as well and decided to give its workers this bonus.
Is this a unique approach or is this sort of indicative of a wider culture in the region?
There is a bonus culture in Singapore and other places in Southeast Asia as well. I think a survey at the end of last year found that about 8 out of 10 companies were going to give bonuses. Usually that's about a month's salary. That's the kind of order they have. And other places like Hong Kong, they regularly give bonuses as well, and workers now expect them. It's called the 13-month salary. So it's certainly not out of kilter, but of course this is way, way beyond a normal bonus.
That was Mickey Bristow, who also deserves an enormous bonus. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses. The producer was Carl Josephs. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.